From WVUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thousands of demonstrators flooded the streets of U.S. cities over the weekend to protest the killing of two black men at the hands of police. Protesters blocking highways, police in riot gear, hundreds of arrests. Here is Baton Rouge.
Why is he being arrested right now?
Why is he being arrested right now? Why is he being arrested?
He didn't do anything.
And in New Orleans.
We're calling on the police departments all over the state of Louisiana, all over the country, to join with us and fight police brutality. We're not fighting police. We're fighting police brutality.
Those killings by police in Minnesota and Louisiana set off a chain of events that have newly ignited the fierce debate over police tactics and race relations, all at a time when the nation mourns the five police officers killed in Dallas. This hour on Point, how can we fix the problems with policing in America and keep police safe? You can join us on air or online. Did you protest this weekend? What's the way forward here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first this hour from Dallas is Malik Aziz. He's the Deputy Chief of Police in Dallas. He's also the Executive Director of the National Black Police Association. Nice to have you with us, Malik. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
So tell us first how the officers on your force are doing, and what can you tell us about the police officers who were wounded in the shootout?
Across your airwaves, I'd like to send my condolences, prayers, and sympathy to the families of the five fallen officers. I can tell you that here we are in a state of disbelief, a state of shock. This is a horrific tragedy for us. Very somber feel, a lot of grief. The feelings of officers here are still, how could this happen here? We're questioning, you know, why, as you would expect. It's just been a very terrible ordeal. It seems like a nightmare that we wake up and it keeps repeating itself for the past few nights here in Dallas. So very, very traumatic for our officers here who were inside of that raging high-powered weaponry gun battle that took the lives of five heroes. And when you speak of those officers right there, a couple of them I know personally, you know, they worked for me, or we interacted with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Very brave, courageous men, family men, husbands, sons, brothers. They, I can't say enough about them. I think in the coming days, when everything is released, what you'll hear is stories of really bravery and courage. When I don't think people understand a lot when the gunfire is happening, when the bad thing is happening, when the bad guy has an intent to kill, those officers went to the face of danger.
Mm.
While everybody else was going the other way, those officers who put their lives on the line and sacrificed their lives and give their lives for citizens of this great city and this country, they ran right into it, and five of them fail as we attempted to take this killer and incapacitate him.
Is anybody still in custody in connection with this case?
There was some unrelated arrest that we believe. I mean, Dallas police investigators are some of the best in the country. They're still, you know, turning over the rocks and making connections or attempting to make connections to make sure that the individuals who were apprehended for unrelated charges that they are not actually in a greater conspiracy or in collusion.
Mm-hmm.
with this killer in any kind of way. So Dallas police, very professional and thorough investigative division, and they're working through that process right now.
We've learned some of what was found in the shooter's home, journals and bomb-making material. Does it suggest he was planning something even worse?
Yes, our chief of police was talking yesterday, Chief David Brown. He was talking, and he was explaining from some of the materials, the explosives. Evidently, he had a real fascination with explosives inside of his house, littered throughout his house. And he was planning for something greater, according to what has been presented to our chief of police, that he would that he was going to do something on a massive level that would wreak havoc on the city. And we just believed that he was waiting on the waves of discontent to step in. So the right opportunity presented himself, and he had been, you know, evidently looking and planning and doing these things, and he used the Black Lives Matter march as a mechanism to carry out his evil plan.
Since the shootings in Dallas, police departments across the country have been taking precautions, ordering police to double up in their cruisers, to work in pairs or even in teams. How has the Dallas police force responded?
You know, Dallas is, you know, we usually we'll leave it up to the officers. We have some a lot of independence. We have some very smart, intelligent commanders, and we advise them to canvass their officers if they feel comfortable going out alone, or if they want to go out with a partner, to accommodate them, and that's what they generally do here, to give a feel. It's a feeling of uneasiness because we still have to protect the city. The city is not sleep. Crime is still going on, and citizens still need to be protected. So while our hearts are heavy and we're full of grief, we're still going out there. And that's what the word that our commanders are giving them. If you need to talk or if you need to ride with someone or you need to feel a little bit more comfortable, then we advise them to do it, and we give them that freedom to do it.
There has been an outpouring of support for the Dallas Police Force. In front of police headquarters in Dallas, here is an African-American woman throwing her arms around a white communications sergeant, Stephen Toff. She's blessing him while crying and apologizing for what happened.
I'm sorry that this happened. In Jesus' name, bless him right now. Amen. I love you.
Deputy Chief, the Dallas Police Department has been considered a leader in community policing and community engagement. Complaints of excessive violence on the part of officers are down 2/3 since your police chief, David Brown, took over in 2010. And police shootings are down from 23 in 2012 to 1 this last year. What do you want people to know post-Dallas about how to bring communities together after the events in St. Paul, in Baton Rouge, and now in Dallas?
Well, and let me explain it, because in the context, many of listeners will understand this. Chief Ben Click came here in 93 and instituted community policing, the interactive community policing program. Chief Bolton, the subsequent chief, the follow chief, he took it up and he expounded on it. Chief David Kunkel, he took up the notch 100 paces about community policing and community engagement. Chief Brown, every chief has tried to outdo the previous chief on community engagement and community policing, Chief Brown being no different. He grasped it, he grabbed it, he laid a foundation for us to propel ourselves into greater community engagement. So the first aspect was that we engage in 2007. I was the first director of the refounded Police Athletic Activities League. We restarted that under Kunkel. Chief Brown expanded it tenfold. He added more people to it, understanding the necessity to engage our youth and form and mold their minds to get them to understand that the police were not their enemy. And that's what we do with 250,000 to 500,000 kids in a year, touching them. And then we reached out to the elderly community. Then we reached out to the young adults, especially black males. After we had a issue in a predominantly black part of town, that after police shooting, officer-involved shooting, where the suspect died, we went to that area with our youth, engaged the youth. Mm-hmm. We went to that area with town hall meetings, health and safety fairs that he calls Chief on the Beats. We have youth forums like Let's Talk, where we gather youth from around the city to come and talk with police. 1,000, 1,500 youth come, and we had one scheduled just this weekend. And then that engagement that we had on what we were doing as a policing model, that was the community side. Internally, what we realized is that we needed, looking at the United Kingdom and how they use verbal skills without weapons to de-escalate issues, that's what we did. We put a lot of de-escalation training for our officers, and then we put reality-based training.
So with that as a background then, Deputy Chief, you see everything that's going on, the protests, the arrests in other cities across this country. As National Chairman of the Black Police Association, what are your thoughts as you see this all unfold? You've done this in Dallas, but a lot of other places have not done what you've done. What are your thoughts moving forward?
And the reason why is 800,000 law enforcement officers with 18,000 police departments, and we're not monolithic. What I would say, even the 21st Century Policing Task Force, which I testified in, that they would actually take some of those ideas and those points and implement them around the country and in cities that I visit. Every department is not the same, and if they would take some of those ideas and programs and implement them and then really engage the community on their territory, on their ground, then they would put themselves in a position to have deposits in the bank. Because here's the problem, Jane. We get withdrawals taken, whether we're good or not. We had a withdrawal taken out the other day when they killed five of our officers. Even though we've done a lot of these things better than most cities, the other cities who have these incidents, it doesn't mean because everybody thinks we're the same that we will suffer. We suffer from their actions if you don't do it in the right way and engage. And
Deputy Chief, I've got about 30 seconds. Let me ask you, what do you want to hear from President Obama when he comes to Dallas tomorrow?
Well, first thing I want to hear from him is I want to see our president, our leader of the free world, extend his condolences and sympathy to the family, embrace law enforcement, and tell the world what law enforcement means to America. The second thing I want the president to do is engage Congress and every governor and mayor of every city to engage in a real national conversation on race and police brutality. And let's get the community and the police together in a partnership, and let's be heard, agree to disagree, and let's argue and debate beautifully and intelligently.
Malik Aziz is the Deputy Chief of Police in Dallas, the Executive Director of the National Black Police Association. Appreciate so much your time, Malik. We send our best wishes to everyone there in Dallas. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jane, and thanks for the prayers. Then.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about policing in America this hour after officers ambushed and killed in Dallas, after killings by police in Baton Rouge and St. Paul. You can join the conversation. Does your community have a good relationship with the police? What's the secret? Here are Black Lives Matter protesters marching through New York City this weekend. This sound is captured by the Associated Press.
Charged with additional crimes. Since you have refused to disperse, you will be placed under arrest.
And in Warsaw on Thursday, President Obama commented on the shootings by police officers in Louisiana and Minnesota. He said that we must continue fixing the relationship between communities and their police departments.
If you can rebuild trust between communities and the police departments that serve them, that helps us solve crime problems. That will make life easier for police officers. They will have more cooperation. They will be safer. They will be more likely to come home. So it'll be good for crime fighting, and it will avert tragedy.
Joining me now from Philadelphia is Charles Ramsey. He was Philadelphia Police Commissioner for about 8 years, and before that he was the Chief of Police in Washington, D.C. He's a proponent of community policing and the co-chair of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Commissioner Ramsey, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
And joining me from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Norm Stamper. He's the former chief of the Seattle Police and the author of the book To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Chief Stamper, welcome to you.
Thanks very much.
Commissioner Ramsey, you put out a report in 2015 with the goal of improving policing in communities across this country. And yet, statistics compiled by the Washington Post show that deaths by police, caused by police, are on the rise since last year, and the number of police officers who are killed is up so far this year. I think those numbers are a source of deep concern for people and frustration. How do you respond to that, especially in light of what the country's experienced this past week?
Well, I mean, I'd like to raise 2 points. One, you know, crime is rising in many cities across America, but and I saw those statistics in the Washington Post, but they're not in any kind of context. We have, on average, about 13,000 murders that are committed in this country every single year. These are not murders or shootings that are committed by police officers. It's people killing people, and there's a disproportionate amount of that going on in many of our challenged neighborhoods. So I think you have to frame it in context, because the people who go after the very individuals who are responsible for those shootings and homicides are the police. There's no context when it comes to just throwing out numbers. How many of those that were killed by police were armed at the time? I mean, these are all important things that need to be part of any report that goes on. That doesn't mean that we don't have some police officers who use excessive force and even engage in deadly force when it's not appropriate to do so. Mm-hmm. But I think just throwing out numbers without any context does no service to anyone.
Chief Stamper, what do you make of the events in Dallas, in Baton Rouge, and in St. Paul? What do you think they mean for the conversations about policing in this country?
Well, they speak to the deep and widespread discontent that many people in our communities across the country have today toward the police. And I think it's vital that we look at what we can do about the structural relationship between community and police.
Chief Ramsey, a lot of the negative and disturbing interactions between police and African Americans that we have seen have taken place in smaller departments, in suburban departments.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you think there's a problem, a discrepancy in resources or training that needs to be looked at between, you know, small police departments and those that are bigger.
You know, I was listening to Malik Aziz earlier, and he was absolutely right when he mentioned that there are close to 18,000 police departments in the United States. It's estimated maybe 800,000 police officers. In my opinion, we have far too many police departments, and we need to take a very serious look at regionalization with some of these smaller departments so we can have better consistency in terms of policies, procedures, training, and the like. We all need to be on the same page, and it's not an easy process to change overnight. And we certainly are going to, it's going to take some time before we implement new training protocols and so forth. But I do think that with 18,000 police departments, it just makes it nearly impossible to really get the kind of training that officers need across the board in every jurisdiction in the United States.
Norm Stamper, do we need more consistency? Are there too many different departments in this country with different policies, different procedures, even different training?
We absolutely need more consistency. With 18,000 police departments and police officers numbering almost a million in this country, every single one of those officers is bound by the Constitution of the United States. There's only one Constitution, and the procedural justice implications that are embedded in the Constitution are, in fact, binding on every single cop in the country. So whether you're talking about a three-officer department or a 35,000-officer department, the Constitution is the Constitution. And what we have seen, I'm sorry to say, is fairly widespread disrespect for the Constitution.
Here's an interview with former Boston Police Chief Ed Davis. This is an interview on Friday on Fox Business. He says that the shootings in Dallas will change how departments police.
This is a game changer. Police now are going to have to worry about force protection, go into a more military mode now when handling any of these demonstrations. I think it's at a time when we're trying to get closer to the community. This throws a wedge in between the police and the community we're trying to serve.
Commissioner Ramsey, do you agree with the chief here, the former chief of Boston, a more militarized mode when it comes to protesters in these demonstrations?
Well, I certainly hope he's not right. I think we have to resist the temptation to overreact. This has been a tragedy. There's no question about it. But I think to then overreact and take protests, which, you know, obviously police officers who are there to facilitate the demonstrators' ability to be able to express their First Amendment rights, you're not looking for it to be something where you're actually risking your life. You know, you may get a little verbal abuse, and it's going to be a long day being on your feet, but you certainly never would think that you would come under attack the way the officers in Dallas came under attack. But that was a unique set of circumstances, and I think that it would be a huge mistake if we went too far in our response. There are going to be a lot of protests. There are a lot of protests taking place. You have two major conventions taking place within the next few weeks. And I think we ought to approach it like we did prior to Dallas. I mean, if there's a need because of circumstances for officers to, put on riot gear or whatever, which, you know, I certainly hope that's not the case. But if it is, that's always available. But I don't think you start off that way. I think that just increases tension, and I think that's just not a good reaction to what took place.
Let's get some callers in here. Aaron in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
First of all, I want to say that I have many friends in the Dallas and Dallas-Fort Worth area, African-American, Hispanic, and Caucasian, and I know how they feel. And how they feel about their police department. None of them has expressed to me any disdain with their police department. So I think everybody needs to realize that there's a perspective relational perspective. Mm-hmm. That the deaths of the African Americans who have been happening all around the country, even though some might want to look at it as they're separate, some of us look at it as they're the same, because black men are being summarily executed by those who are hired to protect. And so even though the young man who acted was misguided in his actions, we have to be mature enough to recognize that he believed, and there may be many others who believe, that he was reacting to some things. Not he didn't initiate this out of thin air. Mm-hmm. It was because of what was going on, and it would be irresponsible, if not delusional, for us to think that this is the end, because it may be the beginning of something if we don't change and start talking to each other in a more healthy and practical way.
It's an excellent point, Aaron, bringing conversations to the fore. Let's hope it doesn't get worse. I appreciate your call. Marcus in Dayton, Ohio, you're on the air next. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you today?
Fine, go ahead.
Great. So I participated in protests yesterday, and hundreds of people there, absolutely zero arrests. It was a wonderful feeling for everybody there. It was such a wonderful feeling, in fact, that some concerns were raised afterwards with the black men I spoke to, who said that it kind of left them feeling unsuccessful, like, what do we do now? We had peace. Now what? And so a lot of what they've talked about afterwards was, well, why don't we work on fixing what's wrong in our community? Because a lot of them feel a sense of we're trapped. We can only get food from like a gas station, or we feel like we have to buy brands, and you're wasting a lot of money and resources in things that don't really matter. Let's do something enriching. Let's work on families. Let's work on building peace from the beginning. And then the relationship with the police will follow.
Marcus, thank you so much. I'm glad you called. Commissioner Ramsey, I've heard one police chief over the weekend say we've been delegating America's social problems to the police, and that the same neighborhoods with the highest rates of violence have the highest rates of poverty, of unemployment, of substandard housing. You know, to Marcus's point, what about the police in that calculus, and how do we address that?
Well, I mean, and that's absolutely true. You know, one of the recommendations in the president's task force report was that a commission or a task force be formed to look at the entire criminal justice system, from the police all the way through probation and parole, every single aspect of it, but also to look at the drivers of crime, poverty, dysfunctional educational systems, dysfunctional families, quite frankly. All those kinds of things need to be looked at and reviewed. The last look at the entire criminal justice system was 1965, when Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States. And obviously, a lot has changed since 1965. We need to really sit down and have thoughtful discussion about all the things that impact crime, that impact incarceration, people's ability to come back into the mainstream and not engage in criminal conduct any longer, behavior of police, how we go about enforcing laws, how we treat people. I mean, yeah, you just go from one end of the spectrum to the other. And until we have kind of thoughtful discussion, nothing's going to change. We're just going to go from viral video to viral video and have the same discussion over and over and over again.
So,
Well, let me turn to Chief Stamper then. Chief, you say in your book that a scared cop is a dangerous cop. Talk about the challenges for police and how to overcome them when things turn negative or even violent.
Well, my observation is that beginning with the launching of the drug war, we made our police officers the frontline soldiers in a very unpopular war. You don't fight a war without an enemy. And tragically, the enemy turns out to be the American people, and particularly young people, poor people, and people of color. So we set up our frontline professionals to fail. It's a very unpopular war. I won't go into all the details associated with the need to reform that system, but I would suggest that we need to demilitarize policing to the maximum extent possible. It would, in fact, help create a much safer police force, but in the end, the most important product would be enhanced trust between community and police, and an improvement in the relationship that would reinforce the idea that the police in America belong to the people, not the other way around.
Let's get Thomas in here from Odessa, Texas. Thomas, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to maybe give a different perspective of
okay.
how I view things. I fully support and back any police work, and I also support the freedom of petitioning or protesting, but only when it does not create a clear and present danger for the public. I also agree with police officers having a full body cam on themselves and a 360 cam that goes all around their vehicle, because they are notified of their Miranda rights. Any individual needs to know what their rights are, and they are notified once they are arrested. But what also needs to be done is that video recording is gold when it comes to court. It's not necessarily what happens, but it's what can be proved in court, because there's always going to be the plaintiff's side. There's always going to be the defendant's side, and video does not lie. If you have several angles of video to watch what actually happens, I believe that there will be no red tape. There is no ifs, ands, or buts. The tape.
You got it right there on tape. Thomas, thank you so much for the call. Speaking of technology, and Commissioner Ramsey, I know you have to go, but I wanted to ask you about the challenge of policing in the glare of social media. We just saw this come over the AP wire, that Detroit police have arrested four men over Facebook postings that the city's police chief says amount to threats against officers. The Detroit News reports that one of the men is accused of urging people to kill white police officers. Talk about technology and people videotaping interactions and how that changes police work.
Well, certainly technology has had a dramatic impact on policing. As far as people videotaping the actions of police, they certainly are entitled and have a right to do that, as long as they're not actually physically interfering with the officer in performance of their duties. But people have the right to do that. I'm a huge proponent of body cameras. I think that when we really have a chance to see an incident from the very beginning all the way through the end, which normally you don't have in those viral videos, something has to attract the attention of an individual before they start filming. So oftentimes you don't see what led up to the actual situation. I think it gives everybody a clearer understanding of what actually took place. And I think that we also have to be mindful of the extreme rhetoric that we're hearing from many people, including some elected officials and others, that is actually leading to some of the kind of hatred and the kind of people that are talking about violence, like you described in Detroit. You know, we have a lot of people that take things to the extreme. And we have some people, unfortunately, in our society that are very violent, and they'll use anything as an excuse. It is not representative of the entire movement that's taking place now, but there are some people that would want to take advantage of that in order to get their agenda across, which is in nobody's best interest.
And so in our last 15 seconds, how do you dial back that rhetoric? We've seen it on both sides.
Well, I mean, I don't know, other than just calling people on it. I mean, you know, and everybody needs to be careful about what they say. Words do matter. We've got a real issue here that has to be resolved, but it's not going to be resolved through violence. And so even what Norm mentioned earlier about, you know, war on crime, we're not at war with our own citizens. We're not at war with the people that we arrest for various crimes. I mean, we're just making an arrest because a person broke the law. I mean, we have to be careful about how we describe things and what we say. And members of the media can be vital in terms of holding people accountable for that when someone on your show uses that kind of language, to call them on it.
Charles Ramsey is the former commissioner of the Philadelphia Police Department, co-chair of the president's task force on 21st century policing. We appreciate your time so much, Commissioner. Thank you. Norm Stamper, stick with us. After the break, Michael Eric Dyson. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from finance's role in addressing climate change to the implications of central bank policy decisions, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about how we can address major problems with America's policing and keep police safe. After violence and killings in Baton Rouge, St. Paul, and Dallas, and protests across the country over the weekend. This is some sound from a Frontline documentary about policing the police, talking about problems with policing and broken window policies in America. In this clip, after being stopped and handcuffed while Newark police search him, one young man voices frustration with the police.
You see so much violence going on in the hoods right now, and not just the hoods, everywhere. You know, the violence from police is crazy right now. And the way y'all approached me, all I was doing was walking home. If y'all would have said, young man, what are you doing?
What are you doing today?
Going home.
Okay.
So I don't care about
the area.
See
how fast that was?
Do not stereotype, because that's what y'all did to me.
A lot of reaction from our listeners on our website. Policing practices won't get any better until we actually address the underlying cause of racial profiling. And that underlying cause is our deeply racist past of violence against black people. We don't discuss it enough. Faith writes, police should be more involved in their communities. Also, it's rare to find a police force that accurately represents the community. If the population is 30% black, 10% Hispanic, 60% Caucasian, then the force should reflect that. You can join the conversation, listeners. Are you hopeful about something positive coming out of all this violence and tragedy? How do we stick together over the long haul? We're joined this hour by Norm Stamper. He's the former chief of the Seattle Police Department. And with me now from Washington is Michael Eric Dyson. He's professor of sociology at Georgetown and an author of many books, most recently The Black Presidency, Barack Obama, and The Politics of Race in America. His recent op-ed in The New York Times is titled Death in Black and White. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Eric Dyson, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
So your op-ed in The New York Times was addressed to white America, talking about the vulnerability that African Americans feel. After Baton Rouge, after St. Paul, after Dallas, what is your message?
Yes. Well, my message is please understand the difficulties, the conflicts, the hurts, the pains, the wounds, the grief we bear. So often this conversation is conducted as if there were no past, as if America had not thought what it thought about black people, as if police people were not the extensions of a brutally racist and violent state that often demonized us. And now we can't expect to erase that automatically overnight because we have a black president. And I think so many other people have been gutted by this amnesia that we don't contend with the past. The point is not simply to point a finger in somebody's face. It's really to be accurate about the impact of the past so that we can gauge what we need to do in the present.
When it comes to policing, go on. Well, I was just going to ask you, Michael, what about Dallas? I mean, with the pictures that we saw and the ease with which the police officers were coexisting with the protesters, police were taking pictures with protesters, they were protecting them, they were guarding them, making sure they were getting from one point to another. But then we saw Baton Rouge and we saw St. Paul. I mean, how does this conversation change now, if at all?
Well, it should make us aware of a couple of things. First of all, things ain't always what they seem. So it's good. I spoke to the police department, especially the black police officers, in Dallas less than a year ago. I was their guest speaker.
So I'm deeply appreciative of and, you know, remarking about what they've been able to do and supportive of what they've been able to do vis-a-vis community policing. That doesn't mean that there still weren't problems. There were. Other African-American people were still speaking about the systemic impact of a particular policy. That would be the same as saying, you know, we see white brothers and sisters and black brothers and sisters holding hands and talking to each other, and those who are in the dominant society treat well those who are not. That's great. But there's still a gross inequality. There's still the Ku Klux Klan. There's still racists out there. There's still vicious people out there who disbelieve in the utter humanity of the other. So the point is that, yes, the police were there. It was a beautiful scene. They were protecting those people. And I've heard some outrage, and, you know, by some, including the lieutenant governor. What a hypocrite black people are. What hypocrites they are. The very people that they were protesting, they ran into their arms as they fled. Well, welcome to our world, sir. We went to wars in foreign territories to defend a democracy we couldn't enjoy here, but we kept on doing it. Partly what this means is something difficult for white America to hear. You must grow up. Stop being childish and infantile about what you see going on in America. Hey, you black people, everything is fine. Stop kvetching. Stop bellyaching. Look at this. If a disproportionate number of white people, white young people were being targeted, were ending up with toe tags and body bags, would we be this sanguine? Would we be this objective? Would we say, hey, that's just the nature of policing?
Let me get a call in here, Michael.
Kids have to die in order for America to move forward. We have to be honest about it.
Got it. Let's get Alyssa in here from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Alyssa, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Yes.
I guess the point I just wanted to make, and been listening. I haven't been able to go to any protests, but I have been listening to radio shows and news and that sort of thing. And I agree. I mean, we have a lot of work to do, especially with African-American males. I think it starts in the education field. I mean, I was a teacher, and my low math classes had 38 students in it, and mm-hmm. my high math classes had 24. Mm-hmm. And the majority of kids in my low math class were males, African-American males. But the reason why I'm calling is I think what we need to step back and remember is that we're, as the one of the arguments is that we're grouping all African males in the same category, that we're racial profiling. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to step back, the people that are talking, the experts, and not group cops all as people that think that an African American male is going to confront them and is a, you know, automatically a gang person or something like that.
Alyssa, I've got it. I want to put your point to Michael Eric Dyson. What do you say to that, Michael? You know, why should we group everyone in the same category?
What would we gain from that? Let's just take that point she made seriously. If we now presume that most cops are not doing the wrong thing, what is the advantage of that? Most black people already are law-abiding citizens who do the right thing, who when the police tell them something, they are fiercely and afraid for their lives. So that they don't have a deficit of respect or recognition for the cops. But what we gain by presuming that this is a systemic problem that has polluted the entire body, what we gain is that we'll be more careful about how we apply these rules, which seem ostensibly objective, but which are unfair and unjust. For example, people say the overwhelming number of cops out here are good people. I have no reason to doubt that, but what does that have to do with the problem we're confronting here? Mm. The overwhelming number of cells out there are not cancerous. Guess what? You got to deal with the ones that are. The cancerous cells are the one destroying the body. The bad cops are the one who are destroying the body politic. Those are the people we have to address.
I hear you. Chief Stamper, how do you respond to that?
I think it's a brilliant analysis, and I wish everybody who has criticized Professor Dyson's column should reread it and do so calmly and to see the fundamental truth that those words contain. Our huge problem, I think, facing this country is systemic racism, systemic poverty, and the need to address the institutional issues of policing. Until we do that, we will be back to this same conversation in the years ahead. So I'm convinced that if we can Number one, end the drug war. Number two, create true community policing, which means the community policing itself with a lot of help from their allies in blue and from other community-based organizations. Citizens should be involved in all aspects of police operations.
Michael
Citizens
Eric Dyson,
should be participating in the hiring of police officers,
I hear you.
For example.
Mike Dyson, I wanted to ask you about the rhetoric, because Commissioner Ramsey brought this up. And I want to play this for you. New York City Mayor, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, last Friday on MSNBC, discredited the Black Lives Matter movement in defense of police officers.
The reason that there's a target on police officers' backs is because of groups like Black Lives Matter that make it seem like all police are against blacks. They're not. They're the ones saving black lives. Black Lives Matter is not saving any black lives. It's the police officers that are doing it.
Michael Eric Dyson, is there a way to bridge this divide, to change the viewpoint and to stop the rhetoric?
Well, the rhetoric is a reflection of the reality. It both drives it, it is an index of it, and it constitutes a particular perspective that needs to be addressed. I think Mayor Giuliani has been part of the problem, quite frankly. You know, our famous tete-a-tete on Meet the Press, where he was basically trying to hijack a concern about Ferguson and in the aftermath of Michael Brown being killed by a policeman to say, hey, it's about black-on-black crime. People kill where they live. Neighbor-to-neighbor violence is endemic in America. 84% of white people who are killed by white people. 93% of black people who are killed by black people. Yet we don't have any language for white-on-white crime. Why? Because there's no historical context to demonize white people as the unique carriers of a virus that has infected American society. So yes, there is a way to bridge that gulf, but partly it has to do with a bit more self-consciousness. As much as I love the chief in Dallas, and he's an amazing man, there's also a bit of me too, oh my God, woe is me-ism operating there, when indeed he used the analogy on CNN of saying that you're in a bad relationship where you love somebody more than they love you. We don't hear often that we are loved. Sir, you are turning table here. Black people say we have done the right thing. Philando Castile, as far as we know, doing the right thing. I'm pointing out what I'm doing. And yet that poor policeman, and I say, yes, poor policeman, is a victim of the same thing that Philando Castile is. A collective sense of grief and danger in the face of black masculinity that, when uncontrolled, will end in lethal consequences. Let me ask you this question. Why aren't more white women killing black people? Why aren't more Latino women, who are cops, I'm saying, killing black people? Why is it that black cops are not killing black people? Why is it that white men in particular disproportionately are killing black people in the inner city? Now, that's a raging empirical conundrum that we need to address if we are to have real progress.
Let's get Sheila in here in Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. Hi, Sheila. You're on the air with Michael Eric Dyson and Norm Stamper.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My background is I'm the daughter of a former chief of police of NYPD, and two of my uncles were detectives. And I ended up spending 3 years volunteering in juvenile, where I witnessed police abuse, and I've witnessed police lying, and I've seen kids thrown into the prison system. So if we want to protect the police, and I do, we need to get to the root of the problem, and blacks, whites, and good police need to get rid of the rogue police, the ones who lie, shoot, kill people, and they're out there, instead of protecting them. And these people who put kids into jail that don't belong there, you know, they're mentally ill, they're black, they're innocent, they're reaching for their ID, they don't need to be protected. By protecting them, you're creating fear and grief in people all across the country, white, black, mothers, you know, who've lost children, and it's becoming, you know, it's becoming something that's going to blow up in the city.
Sheila, thank you. I really appreciate your call. Gary is in Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Gary. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Go ahead.
Okay. I think the common thing that I've heard your guests talk about, and my point, is this idea of fear, which is certainly part of racial inequality. Believe me, as a history teacher and an urban planner and economist, I understand the issue. I'd like to get a comment, though, on, I guess, the balance of power is what we could be talking about between the two races and police in the middle, and specifically on the protesters in the Dallas Thursday event, like 20 to 30 of them, I think the last figure was I heard, carrying rifles as well. and how that fits into how police deal with that and how they wake up in the morning and think, oh, there's going to be somebody carrying a rifle, and who knows, they may point it at me and kill me.
Gary, thank you. We're running out of time. I'm going to turn this to Norm Stamper first. Chief Stamper, what do you say?
Well, I do believe that we have a huge problem with guns in this country, more specifically the problem of guns in the wrong hands. National Rifle Association is very fond of talking about responsible gun ownership, but they've done very little to help this country achieve a level of safety that we all need in order to enjoy our lives. So I think it's vital that we enact smart gun control regulation. I also believe that it's important that we set national standards for policing. In every area of so-called procedural justice, stop and frisk, laws of arrest, search and seizure, and certainly use of force, including lethal force. We have 18,000 law enforcement agencies, as has been pointed out earlier, and yet we have no national standards. So that the cop in Ferguson, the cop in New York, is held to the same constitutional standards of performance and conduct. It's time that we do that. It's time that the people press that demand.
Michael Eric Dyson, I'll end the hour with you here. I'm curious what you think the impact is after Dallas on the larger ongoing discussion of the shooting of African Americans by police. Does it force in any way, to your mind, some sort of humility on both sides?
Well, let me just very briefly answer the question that just got asked. Why is it that when black people possess guns in an open carry state where it's legitimate and legal, all of a sudden it becomes a problem that the police cannot address, and yet white men walk around every day with Confederate flags and guns and there's no problem? Now, to answer your point, yes, humility is already in place when black people have finally arisen to the point where they say Black Lives Matter and they have enough courage and will not be discouraged by anything that occurs. A lunatic black fringe that this young man occupied cannot in any way detract from the legitimate moral force of an argument. In fact, it makes police safer when we expunge these kind of men. Why? Because even Black Lives Matter and the police agree that what this man did is wrong. So now that we can collectively conclude that what he did was evil, vicious, and wholly destructive, let us also point out the ways in which, the spots in which, the blind spots of white America that have precluded any sensibility or any sensitivity about the average black person and what they confront. All we're asking is stop killing us. Stop shooting us. And if it was a real problem that didn't involve race, why aren't many more white people dying in proportionate numbers? We know overall more white people are killed by police-involved shootings than blacks, but the disproportionate number of black and brown people who are targeted suggests that we have an ongoing racial problem.
We will keep this important conversation going. Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown University, appreciate your time. Thank you. Norm Stamper, former chief of the Seattle Police Department, thank you. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. And listeners, thanks to you. This is On Point.